And so I began to look at, again, taking a functional medicine approach of how do we fall asleep and how do we stay asleep? What's the biochemistry between getting yourself to sleep and getting yourself to stay asleep?
Today, my guest is Dr. Dean St. Mart, also known as the Irish Andrew Huberman. He's an international bodybuilder, champion kickboxer, and now a product formulator and renowned fitness industry pharmacologist. Coming up, the importance of diet and supplements and how they should be personalized. Understanding female hormones and the menopause. Pros and cons of competitive bodybuilding and the effects of taking steroids and how they can be reversed. Dean, welcome to my show. I am so excited to have you on. As somebody that's been on stage a couple of times, nowhere near what you've been doing, but it's a complete honor to have Mr. Ireland on my show.
I've never been called that. Thank you very much, Sonia.
Well, I think you've actually been called a few things. I think another one of them is the Irish Andrew Huberman.
Yes, yeah, so I've been told, which again is a huge honour considering how I hold Andrew in such high regard.
He's fantastic. Well, look, Dean, for my audience, could you give me a little overview of your background?
Yeah. So I'm Dr. Dean St. Mart. My background is in drug design and drug pharmacology. So I have a double first class honours degree in chemistry and pharmaceutical chemistry. And I went on then to do a PhD in synthetic chemistry after that. Following all the academia pursuits, I went and became a chemical engineer. And I worked at Intel as one of their senior shift engineers for nearly 8 years before I took the leap and joined my friend in our company Supplement Needs, where we've striven for the last 4 to 5 years to really place our name within that sort of sphere of putting consumers' health first, really showing people the sort of fallacies that the supplement industry is playing into people. And I think even yourself, Hussein, when we were exhibiting at the Health Optimization Summit, sort of what we've taken in terms of each organ system of the body and made supplements to cater for each system.
Great. And look, it'd be great to get a little bit more into detail on those supplements. But before that, where did your passion for sort of the body come from? Where was this? Yeah, where did you get that?
Yeah, so I've always been active growing up. I played football and Gaelic football and hurling, the Irish sports, to a really high level during my teenage years. And I was also very passionate about martial arts. So one of the things that sort of led me into bodybuilding was I had a really bad accident training with kickboxing where I smashed the bones of my ankle. And part of that rehab was, you know, going to the gym, building back up the strength of my leg. And with that, sort of seeing my body completely change, because I had a period of like 6 months of just dedicating myself to rehab in the gym, focus on what I'm eating. And the change that came about from that rehab process made me realize, you know, there's this whole other thing around bodybuilding. My dad had a big sort of passion about bodybuilding when he was growing up. He never competed himself, but he loved to go to gym. And that sort of, you know, sparked my mind. Maybe we'll give this a try. Maybe we'll just enter into a bodybuilding show to see what it's all about. And from there, I was hooked for, like, I think I competed over 11 years from wow. The age of 23 up until last year when I retired. So it's one of those pursuits that it's like a self pursuit, because like I said before, bodybuilding, it was martial arts and sort of sports like football and etc. And with something like kickboxing, it's like an objective sport. You either win or you lose. Same with football. You can't argue of what happens. Whereas with something like bodybuilding, it's it's a really subjective sport that you're really laying yourself open to complete criticism from a panel of complete strangers. And then being able to take that criticism from what they've told you about, oh, this is lacking in your physique, or this is why you didn't place first. And being able to take that criticism and actually figure, okay, I need to put these plans in place to improve myself, to come back and be better. So it's almost like it's, to me, I view bodybuilding as something that you're entering into to pursue the betterment of yourself, as opposed to entering it as a sport to win. Because if you just enter bodybuilding with the goal of winning trophies, you're going to be sorely disappointed when judges start tearing your physique apart. No matter how good you are, it's down to their opinion versus yours. And I became fascinated. It was almost like what I said to you, and that you get hooked. You do your first one or two shows, and it's just like, oh, I want to get back on stage again. The sort of the excitement, the thrill of competing on stage. It there's no you can't describe the feeling to people of how it feels being up there.
Well, I definitely relate to that. And I mean, I learned a lot about myself when I went through it, and I only competed a couple of times, and I'm still not saying never again. But yes, I didn't realize what was involved. And I think the one thing I really discovered is it takes so much willpower and determination. I mean, forget even getting in front of a whole auditorium and the judges, because that's one thing. And that's something I've probably been less bothered with. But for me, it was more of the battle with myself. What did you learn about yourself going through the different
Ooh.
processes?
I think one of the things that really instilled into me was like mental resiliency. I'm definitely a stubborn person. I'm definitely someone who, if someone tries to prove me wrong, I'm going to prove myself right towards them. And so it was almost like the competition season last year was very, very different to other years in that I'd taken a 5-year break from competing. I got married. We had our two young boys. And it was sort of like one of my goals was always to win Mr. Ireland, to win the bodybuilding class in Mr. Ireland. And it was sort of just came to a head fall of with my wife that it's either now or never. But one of the things that was completely different to the other years competing was I'd sort of really instilled in myself the mental belief that I'd already won. So every single day I was telling myself, you've already won, you're just turning up, you're doing the work. And rather than thinking that I'm going to win or doing everything to think that you're going to win, I actually instilled like that sort of positive mental image of you are a champion and you have won, and that self-affirmation. Before that, I didn't really appreciate how powerful that mental thought process is to shaping your environment and your actions to match it. So definitely it's taught me discipline. Discipline's probably the biggest thing, like you're seeing, even the discipline to the nutrition to me, because of bodybuilding and other sports, nutrition has always been just a sort of like a body fuel to me. Now, don't get me wrong, I do like I do like some foods that we all like from time to time, but for me, I sort of view nutrition as, is this sort of serving my health today, or is it going to create dishealth or disease later on in life? And that's sort of what guides my nutrition practices day to day. So from a diet perspective, the not eating a lot of food technically didn't really bother me, in that you have, oh, I wish I had this sort of like chocolate or whatever else. It never really played into my mind. The biggest part, I guess, was the discipline to actually be able to turn up every day and do your cardio, do your like 10 or 12,000 steps a day, manage, work expectations, manage family life. It was sort of like they were the biggest lessons that were taken away from bodybuilding, not only giving you sort of the health of a really, lean physique, but also the mental discipline lessons that come from being a competitor.
And I think if you haven't been through it, it's very difficult to describe. I mean, the very fact that you had your family as well. When I did it, I was single, and I couldn't have even thought about being with anybody else because I was all consumed over, you know, what was I going to eat today? What wasn't I going to eat today? When was I going to train today? And the other parts of life. But thinking about another person and your family as well, that must have been, I'm guessing, quite difficult or challenging.
You'd think that, but before I entered into the dieting phase, I made a promise to myself that nothing would change family-wise. So the prep revolved around family life rather than family life revolving around prep, which tends to be the way for a lot of bodybuilders. So I built, you know, daily routines in to facilitate family life. So, you know, I get up in the morning at 5 o'clock and do my half an hour cardio in the garage on the cross trainer, come in, the boys would be awake, we'd have breakfast, and then you know, part of my daily routine was, you know, anywhere from 10 up to 15,000 steps. So that was, you know, 1 to 2 hours of walking per day. So I just put the boys into the double buggy and we'd go off for a walk in the morning time. So I, you know, you structured your prep around the boys. Obviously, it was, you know, a little more difficult bringing them out places where they're eating ice cream and are expecting daddy to eat ice cream. And you're just trying to say, oh no, daddy doesn't want any ice cream today.
Daddy doesn't like ice cream.
You can eat daddy's ice cream. Like you're trying to facilitate family life to support your goal as well without neglecting that side. And that was quite important. Obviously towards like the last maybe 2 or 3 weeks before the actual shows, when you're really like down to the depths of like 4 to 5% body fat, you are a little more tired. So there is a little bit of leeway there in terms of like on a Sunday, I might only last 2 or 3 hours of running around and bringing the boys out and then obviously swapping with my wife. But there was that, you know, obviously that exchange and that support from my wife, understanding that when you get so close, then you are going to have a level of fatigue that no matter what you do, you're not going to really, you know, sway it away or rest it away. It's just going to be there as part of the process. But having that understanding, obviously, from a, you know, my wife was a competitor as well. So she'd done bikini for 4 years, and that's how we met one another. So she understood what it takes to get to that level, but also understood that I wasn't willing to, you know, sacrifice a lot of things with missing time with the boys. So it really last year, as much as you think it was a challenge, it wasn't that great of a challenge, because the other side of it was I didn't have a lot of idle time versus when I was younger, where you were being occupied by the boys, you're being occupied by other projects, as opposed to, you know, clock watching of, oh, my next meal is coming now, or I have to go and do this. And it, you know, last year that did pretty much the, I think the whole dieting phase was about 26 weeks long from May all the way till the start of November. But that time went like that before I knew it was Christmas time. So it, you know, it really went so fast, and we're having the routines in place to support family life. It was probably my most enjoyable prep ever. And very hard to come away from a prep like that and realize that that's it. You've achieved your goal. You know, you're going to retire now. You're not interested in anything else in terms of pursuing anything further in bodybuilding. And it's difficult then, because you have this bodybuilding persona that you've had for so long that you have to almost dissolve that ego of, you know, realizing that your training is now more important for health and your nutrition is more important for your future longevity, as opposed to for the aesthetics and being, you know, quite muscular, etc. I mean, I definitely don't miss, like, sort of in retired life, of having to chase after eating a lot of food, putting on a lot of weight to maintain muscle mass. Like at my peak, my heaviest weight was just over 17 and a half stone, so 108 kilos, and which is a lot of size to carry around. And
yeah,
especially if you've got two young boys and you're trying to run around after them, it's a little uncomfortable.
So where then does the link, or can you see the link between bodybuilding and what you're doing now with supplement needs? Talk me through that process. Did one lead to another?
So I was always very passionate about taking care of our health from a holistic perspective. So obviously with the background in drug design and how drugs work in the body, I became a little sort of dismayed at how the whole pharmaceutical industry is resolved around when we're researching for pharmaceuticals. It tends to be focused centered on symptoms. So how can we alleviate a symptom of a disease rather than getting to the root cause of a particular ailment? And that sort of led me into looking at, for example, even with bodybuilders who may use performance enhancing drugs, that they themselves can cause health detriments, but no one ever sat and questioned where those health detriments stemmed from. So what was the root cause of why a performance enhancing drug might cause heart disease or cause high blood pressure or cause liver issues? And that led me down the path of developing a really big interest in functional medicine, of looking at root cause mechanisms to fixing diseases or fixing health ailments. And I was sort of tying in with what I was doing at the time in being an engineer. I mean, as an engineer, your job is to figure out the root cause to a dysfunction in a machine or a process. So you're using that those same sort of investigation and detective skills to work your way backwards through a set of symptoms to get to why those symptoms or disease is starting to manifest. And so I started to do a lot of research on like supplements that play into heart health. What were some of the mechanisms that really drove heart disease? And was a big interest of mine in that when we look at heart disease, we all know that atherogenic plaque. So when we develop high cholesterol and the plaque that generates from that cholesterol triggers off potentially a thrombotic event, a clotting event, where you end up with a blood clot that can trigger a heart attack or an aneurysm or a stroke. How that comes to form in the first place, and that we're always focusing on, your bad cholesterol, having high cholesterol, but where along that line does the actual disease develop from? And you start to see that it's got to do with oxidative stress and your body damaging your cholesterol to a point where your body has no choice but, because the cholesterol is damaged, to remove it from your bloodstream. And in the process, it forms a plaque as a consequence. And so you see then that oxidative stress comes from an imbalance in your exposure to oxidants that are in the environment or in the food that you eat, versus your antioxidant intake, which is what your body can make naturally through a lot of enzymes, or through your intake of antioxidants like vitamin E and vitamin C and your vitamin A. So when I started to realize all this, it sort of really drove the passion of, first and foremost, with supplement needs, it was to try and educate generally young men and young women who may be using these performance enhancing drugs to look at how the diseases that come from their usage here can be stemmed away with supplements and the correct nutrition and advice. And so that's sort of where the development of our heart stack, our liver stack, our kidney stack, the thyroid stack, everything sort of built around clinical research on specific supplements that have been shown to have, they lower your LDL oxidation, so they're very, very good antioxidants. The liver stack help with your bile flow so that you're detoxing the liver correctly into the small intestine and you're not causing any fat to build up to cause fatty liver disease. And then like the kidney stack and blood pressure, looking at natural ways to improve the dilation of your blood vessels so that you have, more blood flow and more oxygenated blood, and also potentially taking some stress away from your kidneys because blood pressure is one of the silent destroyers of your kidney health. So all that was sort of like a hobby while working as an engineer, helping Lee, who had began supplement needs as a as its own health line. And I just basically approached him and said, oh, I've got these ideas. The very first one actually was a sleep product called a sleep stack, which was six natural ingredients. So two of it.
Please tell me more, because I think everyone needs
Yeah,
sleep stack.
sleep.
Particularly being a sort of a menopausal woman, where sleep's quite difficult, and you might be on the sort of hormones, etc., which can help, but still,
Yeah.
that's the one big thing I really struggle with.
And that was how I sort of became very well known in terms of supplement formulation, was with our sort of initial product, and that was the Sleep Stack. And the Sleep Stack came about from, and you probably see this now, a lot of the teams in terms of the supplements that were made with supplement needs were actually made for me. So if I'm making something, I'm going to formulate it so it protects my health. And I'm not going to cut any corners on my health. So I'm not going to cut any corners towards the consumer's health. So the Sleep Stack came about. I was working, obviously, a rotating shift pattern of a day, a month of day shift, and then a month of night shifts. And what you're told when you enter into like corporate industry with shift patterns and occupational health, a lot of the information that's given to you is quite false and how to navigate through something like working shift. And obviously, we now know that shift patterns do bring about a level of carcinogenicity and future health detriment because you're going against your
Yes, circadian.
circadian biology. And obviously, on the days when I was having to sleep during the day after night shift, obviously with being a bodybuilder and doing competitions during that career process, I had to figure out a strategy that I couldn't, sacrifice my sleep quality or quantity, and ensure that my mental performance in terms of my work didn't suffer as a consequence either. And so I began to look at, again, taking a functional medicine approach of how do we fall asleep and how do we stay asleep? What's the biochemistry between getting yourself to sleep and getting yourself to stay asleep?
I think that's so important when people talk about sleep. And, I spent 20 years not bothering about sleep. Being in the corporate world, I was the opposite. It was like, let's go out and party, rest our bodies. Yeah, you can sleep when you're dead. Do you remember that expression? You can sleep when you're dead. And then realizing sort of in the last few years how important sleep is, particularly obviously when you're training for a competition, and especially with muscle building, you need sleep. And now you actually need, all those people out there that are trying to lose weight. If you don't get adequate sleep, your body's not going to be in a state, that's when you're losing weight.
And the other side with sleep, you don't get adequate sleep, your appetite hormones actually get severely skewed, so you tend to overeat to compensate for that lack of sleep. So with like the Sleep Stack, this was sort of my own personal formula that I was using as a chemical engineer. And when Lee started the supplement needs line, I basically said to him, listen, I've got this sort of six ingredient natural supplement stack that I take for my sleep when I'm working both day shifts and night shifts. It's very straightforward. It's two vitamins, two minerals, and two amino acids. And it plays off such a simple biochemistry that when you explain it to people, they'll be sort of like, whoa, how come I never thought of this sort of combination of
And
how simple it is?
you say it's totally natural, because obviously
Completely.
there are sleeping pills out there, which I try not to touch unless I'm so desperate.
Yeah, so there's absolutely no sedative ingredients in this. So that was one thing that really irked me in like the supplement industry, is that you have sleep products, but they're all based around either depressive supplements in that they depress your nervous system to get you to sort of calm down. And they never really force your brain along the actual biochemistry of falling into deep sleep. So yes, you fall asleep, but the quality of the sleep is quite poor. And that's where a lot of like even conventional therapies like benzodiazepines or some of the antidepressants or antipsychotics that are prescribed for sleep do a good job of getting you to relax so you close your eyes, but you never go through the four sleep stages correctly. So you never really get the same quality of sleep as you would if you were to naturally fall asleep. But it's better than lying in bed suffering with insomnia or anxiety of worrying that you're not getting sleep. So those compounds or those drugs serve a purpose for temporary relief, but you never coach people on how to actually encourage the brain to fall asleep naturally and then to stay asleep naturally.
It's that staying asleep. I have no problem getting to sleep, and I go to bed. I make sure I get my trying to get my 8 hours sleep. So I'm often in bed at 9 o'clock, 9, 10 o'clock if I can. But yeah, I wake up
pretty consistently at about 3 o'clock, and I can be up sometimes for an hour.
When it comes to that, it can be two things. So obviously we have to have a very calm brain for our body to fall asleep. So we have to feel safe. The environment has to be correctly adequate for your sort of sleep needs, so that your brain actually feels safe to allow you to go sleep. Because your sleep is a quite a vulnerable process that your security of your mind and your body needs to be at the foremost forefront before your body will actually allow you to fall asleep. The other side of it is obviously then your neurotransmitters in your brain. So like you've got excitatory neurotransmitters that make you feel motivated and happy. And then you've got inhibitory neurotransmitters, which tell your brain to calm down. And so in order for you to fall asleep, you have to have this really calm brain environment where you've got low dopamine, you're not stimulated. So that comes down to, why you shouldn't be on your phone, or why you should be sort of avoiding blue light, which can stimulate our brains. And I try not engage in any sort of social activities that will wire you or cause, very excitatory thought processes that would stimulate you to stay awake, basically, where you're thinking, what if, what if, what if? And that's where obviously meditation comes in, and that you're able to look at these thoughts and try and absolve or dissolve some of those thoughts away, or why journaling before bed helps get rid of these sort of spurious thoughts that can keep you awake. So that's really all down to falling asleep is creating the correct brain environment, the correct sleep hygiene, having the correct, room temperature, lighting, having a very dark room, your bed sheets, your bed, your pillow, everything like that plays into this small little additions to getting you to fall asleep. But then staying asleep comes back to your melatonin. And a lot of people view melatonin as this potential supplement. It's actually a hormone that your body makes. And so your melatonin helps you to fall asleep at night also. So obviously, as it gets darker, our brain with the circadian rhythm secretes melatonin in order to get the brain to sort of signal to reflective genes in our body that it is nighttime and to get ready for sleep. But it also sustains our sleep, and that it tells our body it's still nighttime outside to continue sleeping. Most people think that melatonin comes from your sunlight exposure. So when you go out and you're exposing sunlight into your eyes, your pineal gland within your brain is making melatonin from sunlight. But that melatonin that you're making from sunlight exposure is just enough in order for your body to basically know that it's nighttime and to fall asleep. It doesn't sustain you through sleep. What does that is your serotonin. Your sort of feel good neurotransmitter gets converted to melatonin during sleep. So in order for you to stay asleep, you have to have high levels of serotonin in your brain to fall asleep. So it's calming to your brain. But then that high amount of serotonin gets converted to melatonin while you're sleeping. And that's why, when you take in a very like carbohydrate rich meal, and where you have a lot of tryptophan present, which is raising your serotonin, that you feel sleepy. And that's why a lot of time people have really good restful sleep after having heavier meals later in the evening, because of they've increased their serotonin and now their brain has enough to keep doing that conversion process over to melatonin to stay asleep.
So actually, eating and funnily enough, going back to one of those fallacies, don't eat carbs after six, which obviously is a fallacy, can actually be good for you to have the right carbs after to help you with your sleep.
Most definitely, it's one of the simplest things that you can do to try and raise tryptophan in your brain. And that's sort of why then the sort of old wives' tales of avoiding like very processed dairy or anything sort of that matter close to bedtime is because you have tryptamine and tyrosine in your sort of dairy, which leads to dopamine in your brain. So that can, have you a little more stimulated, or it can lead to, obviously, in certain people, it can lead to nightmares because of that excitatory thing when they have dairy close to bed.
So I'm just having aha moments because I had, although I said I didn't sleep much last night, I had a lot of nightmares. But I'd had a lot of goat's cheese before going to bed, Literally, I think I ate the entire thing. But maybe we'll come on to diet. So, Dean, do you actually believe we need supplements if we actually get the right diet?
This is something that I am probably one of the straightest talking sort of supplement industry, I guess, experts, if you want to make me that way, in that when people come to me and ask, you know, especially at like expos, oh, what supplements would you recommend? My very first response is always, well, what are you deficient in from your diet? What is your blood work showing in terms of what do you feel you need to support? I don't personally believe that everyone needs supplements, provided that their nutrition is adequate. But we're entering slowly into, you know, an age where people don't really pay attention too much to nutrition. So nutritional deficits do creep in. Our environmental exposure to oxidants like pollution, electromagnetic radiation, stuff that we can't necessarily feel ourselves, but our cells feel it. We need to be pretty much in tune with, maybe we do need to support our body a little bit better these days in terms of our vitamin E, our glutathione, NAD, all these sort of buzzword supplements that became very popular. There might be, you know, merit to using these things, given that our environment is slowly changing and we are encountering a lot more oxidants within our environment compared to maybe 15, 20 years ago. But it's definitely, they are supplements in that we call them dietary food supplements for a reason, because they're designed to be treated like food. They're designed to make up for what you are lacking from your diet. So if you're not eating a lot of polyphenols or antioxidants from veg or colorful fruit, then perhaps a multivitamin that has these micronutrients, like more exotic minerals such as molybdenum and manganese, selenium, stuff that's going to be deficient in the soils of our foods, maybe then we might need a multivitamin to make up for that deficit. But we shouldn't be instantly anchoring on the thought process of there's a supplement for X and there's a supplement for Y. It always stems back to lifestyle management and the nutrition first, and then use those supplements to actually give you sort of the icing on the cake.
I think certainly where I was, say, 10 years ago, living a very different lifestyle, I thought I could almost supplement my bad lifestyle by supplements. And of course, we've got so many supplements out there and everyone's trying to market you. You know, look, you can look like this if you take this supplement, and, you know, you've got this bad diet, but hey, take these supplements and you'll be great. And I think, certainly, and I obviously I'm speaking as a woman, you know, women go through so many yo-yo diets, from no carb to Special K to, I mean, you know, I think I've been on every single diet there is out there. And it wasn't until I, funnily enough, I found the bodybuilding and started bodybuilding, I realized how important nutrition was. And obviously that's quite an extreme way of looking at it, but you really understand why you should be eating whole foods, not processed foods, because you can track and measure macronutrients, etc. And that's where I became fascinated with the whole food thing. But in terms of, if we're talking more sort of specifically for women that have been on these sort of different diets and yo-yo diets, what are the best supplements that a woman can take?
So when we sort of look at female health needs and sort of the deficits that come from it, probably the main ones that we need to really consider would be the likes of your sort of B complex. So all your B vitamins, ranging from vitamin B1, thiamine, to vitamin B9, folate, vitamin B7, biotin, which most women are familiar with for skin, hair, and nail health, and your vitamin B12. Then sort of the other ones that play into your energy metabolism would be your vitamin B2, your vitamin B3. So a B complex, unless you're eating quite a lot of leafy green vegetables and you're getting in an adequate amount of fibrous vegetables, your vitamin B intake will suffer slightly, especially again with vitamin B12 mainly coming from red meat sources. you end up with these sort of small little deficits that you don't really feel overall in the sort of present time, but slowly over time, those deficits towards your energy metabolism start to appear. And I mean, a lot of B complex products are sort of sold on the basis of that they improve your overall health in terms of your energy level. And more so when it comes to female health needs, the impact that your sort of folate and B12 have on your daily energy levels, because they control how your body basically controls your DNA and your genetic expression. And then on the other side of it, you have your neurotransmitters coming off the back of that sort of folate and B12 metabolism also. So it's important from a historical perspective, looking at, was there always, you know, your folate and B12 needs being taken care of with diets? And generally, when we're looking at quite restrictive diets, depending on sort of how that person has been bought into all these different tribes of nutrition. So again, you're going to have your sort of Weight Watchers versus, I guess, Slim and World, where there's all different sort of nutritional protocols where people are being coached on potentially, you know, avoid this food, but you can eat as much of this food as you like. There's never really, like you said, a coaching perspective on, well, let's strip everything away. Let's stop worrying about whether you can fit this curly whirly bar into your daily diet. And like, let's build from the ground. Let's put in our sort of fibrous veg. Let's put in our sort of complex carbohydrates, and let's focus on lean proteins. And then from there, yes, we can all, you know, entertain small little treats, given the fact that maybe we should follow this sort of 80-20 rule or even 90-10 rule towards your nutrition. Now, you can still enjoy foods, you can still enjoy sweet treats, but the majority of your nutrition should be around, like I said, serving your body and serving how your body turns over these macronutrients to repair your cells, to create neurotransmitters in your brain. And so when you look at, you know, someone who's chronically dieting or doing yo-yo dieting, there's probably going to be periods where, depending on how they've received your nutrition information, they're either going to rely a lot on, like, I guess, watery-based vegetables. So again, they may get enough sort of spinach and lettuce and broccoli, as to speak, that would be serving some of their micronutrient needs. But it could be the complete opposite, where they've sort of been bought into, well, I can have a cup of tea with two biscuits, and this is like, you know, 200 calories. And then later on at lunch, I'm going to have a chocolate bar with a coffee. And they're almost like tracking calories, which there's no problem to, because our whole body is developed around using food to create calories for energy burning. But again, if their nutrition choices are using foods that contribute to more towards causing stress to the body, as opposed to serving the nutrition with the micronutrients like the B vitamins, etc., that person who may have followed that sort of lifestyle for a long period of time probably would see a huge change to their mood, to their vitality, by incorporating something like B vitamins, or looking at, you know, their multivitamin with minerals that they might have been lacking from chronic lacking the intake of taking, you know, vegetables, etc. in. So
sorry, go.
Yeah. No, I was going to say the other thing then, obviously with female health then as well, is the thyroid, in that your thyroid's the key driver of your metabolism, and the active thyroid hormone that your body's producing in order to help your body use these, you know, carbohydrates, fats, and proteins for energy and repair. So you can see small dysfunctions to thyroid health if the gut health isn't correct, if there's a chronic lack of tyrosine, the amino acid, or some of the cofactors like iodine or selenium being lacked from in the diet, the thyroid starts to suffer. And so again, the metabolic rate of the female starts to slow down.
Gosh, I've got so much unpacking there to look at. In terms of the thyroid, how do you know if you've got issues with your thyroid?
It comes back to the same question when people ask me a supplement, blood test. So you're going to look at in your blood work, you have about three very commercial markers that you can have checked, and then you can have two very specialized markers. So your brain produces a hormone called thyroid stimulating hormone, and that stimulates then your thyroid to create your inactive thyroid hormone, which is called T4, and your T4 can get converted to the active thyroid hormone called T3. So the TSH stimulates the thyroid into producing the T4 and T3. As we potentially see nutritional deficits occur, the cofactors that help with your thyroid hormones, like the tyrosine and the iodine, if they're lacking, you're going to see a small drop off in terms of the overall health of the hormones that your thyroid is making. And so what can happen is the brain thinks, okay, I need to stimulate the thyroid more, and you produce more and more TSH to try and stimulate the thyroid to produce those hormones. So if we suspect there's thyroid hormone issues, we might see the TSH quite elevated. So anything above 2.1 tends to tell us that the thyroid is being, consistently stimulated by the brain to a higher extent than normal. And we can check the levels of your T4 and T3 hormones in your blood to see, are they at a low level or are they at a high level? And from that, we can, deduce back to then, are there any sort of diseases that are coming from the lack of nutrients in the diet, where the brain is having to try and stimulate the thyroid gland more often? Or the other side that is completely ignored, and it's a significant contributor to your thyroid health, is your gut. So your gut does a lot of thyroid hormone transformation of the inactive thyroid hormone to your active thyroid hormone. And if your gut health and the bacteria within the gut aren't correct, that conversion process will slow down. So you'll see, I guess, a slow turnover rate of your active thyroid hormone and all the goodness that it brings. So the nutrient side is very important, but then the gut health side is just as important also.
God, there's so many different things to sort of take into account. Added to that is we all want to look good, back to body composition. And I guess we've got ourselves to this state by looking on Instagram, by looking at men, women that have got these perfect bodies, but we actually don't know what's going on inside. So is there a best diet for body composition in particularly in women? And what sort of supplements can women sort of support
Interesting.
that diet with?
So I always try to explain this in that everybody's own individual body is genetically unique, in that we don't all have the same metabolism. We don't have all the same sort of structures to the body. There are some similarities, but generally, everyone is going to have very different biochemistry processes happening. And what that means is, for example, if you take one person and you feed them a lot of carbohydrates, their energy utilization might not be correct for carbohydrates, and that their energy system of how that person's body has evolved and developed might be more suited towards burning fats. And this is sort of where you start to see, tribes come in of, oh, well, low carb, high fat is a great diet, or, high fat, low carb is a great diet. You see that different people burn energy substrates quite differently. And so you have to almost gain an understanding of just trial and error, of trying to see, well, what serves my body better? Is it carbohydrates? Is it fats? Or is it a mixture of both? You have people who will utilize both energy systems very efficiently at the same extent. And so you can then start to see then, okay, well, my body preferentially prefers to burn carbohydrates or glucose over fats. So I'm going to maybe have a diet that's 45, 50% carbohydrates. I'm going to look to support my protein intake, maybe somewhere around 2 grams of protein per kilo, or even going as high as 1 gram per pound body weight.
And yet, you know, when I talk to certainly women and probably even a lot of men, I talked to a guy the other day, actually was on a podcast, and he said, oh, how much protein do you have? And I said, I try and have at least 1 gram per pound of body weight. So I'm about 105 pounds. So I try and take at least 105 grams of protein. He was out. He was like, what? Oh my God, I take no, and this is a guy, he's like, I eat about 30 or 40 grams.
Yeah.
So people are really under eating protein, right?
And it's sort of like, there's almost like a stigma attached to protein for some reason. But protein as an energy substrate, you can't, well, I'm not going to say you can't, but technically you can't overeat protein. So it comes to a point where it's a very inefficient process for your body to convert amino acids to fat. So the benefits that you gain from eating quite a lot of protein are, it has a higher thermic effect. So your body, out of all the macronutrients, your body actually has to use quite a lot of calories to break down proteins in order to use them. So there's a great energy buy-off here that you're eating quite a lot of protein, but it's also requiring your body to use quite a lot of energy to digest and break down that protein, that it's a good trade-off. So if you're sort of looking at how you're building up a diet, as to speak, especially even for women, that emphasis on, you know, the sort of metric way of looking at it is around 2 grams per kilo, or you come at it from a little slightly higher, and I personally prefer this, is the 1 gram per pound body weight. That is sort of your anchor of, this is what you need every single day, regardless of what you do with carbohydrates and fats. That protein anchor stays there, and that's going to contribute to your skin, your hair, your nails, your muscles, your neurotransmitters of your brain, some of your hormones that rely on amino acids to be created. And then from there, obviously, let's just for argument's sake say that 1 gram per pound puts your sort of total calorie intake towards protein at 30%. So now you've got 70% of sort of the rest of your calories to contribute to either carbohydrates or fats, in whatever ratio you deem necessary. Generally, we want to sort of look at anywhere from 0.25 to 0.5 grams of fat per pound. So that ends up roughly working out at about 20% of your overall daily calories. So if you've got your 30% from the protein, the 20% from your fats, you're sort of left with then a 50% dominance towards your carbohydrates. For the person who might not necessarily find, and again, the whole thing that carbohydrates can make you fat, the process of creating fat from carbohydrates, again, is a very energy inefficient process called de novo lipogenesis. So your liver creates these fats from glucose. You have to be chronically eating a high amount of carbohydrates for your body to basically realize that we need to convert this to fat for excessive energy storage. Because again, that's what why your body stores fat is for energy storage. So there's either an energy surplus where the body just doesn't need that energy right now, but knows that it might need it in future and stores it into your fat cells. Or in the case of certain types of fat, some of it can get stored directly as fat in your cells. If your body can't utilize the fat for energy, it's going to do the second best thing, and that's to store it so it can try and use it later on. And so you have to understand, again, how your body metabolizes these nutrients, the glucose or the fatty acids, and how it stores fatty acids more preferentially than using them. So in that case, you might want to be on the lower side of fat intake and predominantly use carbohydrates then for fuel. But this sort of vilifying of carbohydrates and fats, really, it's sort of crazy when you think about it, that people are sort of afraid to eat protein, but then they're also afraid to eat carbohydrates and fats. But they're not afraid to eat like a processed food or something like that, where it's sort of like we've really detached ourselves from the basics of human nutrition, on being made to feel sort of fear towards certain foods than being educated on the health impacts that come from eating those foods.
And in terms of the effect on longevity as well. And a lot of people are talking about plant-based diets and how the Mediterranean diet as well is very good in terms of, you know, health benefits and living healthily, quality of life for longer. Have you got a sort of view on that? And let's put an intermittent fasting in the basket as well.
I mean, when you even look at like caloric restriction, the whole point surrounding longevity is building proteins to the body is a fascinating thing, in that we can build proteins such as our muscles and our effectively some of the structures in our body that are enzymes. So proteins themselves can be enzymes as well, and they do, you know, chemical reactions for our body. But the more proteins that we create, potentially the more issues that may arise in our body. So if our body's making a lot of proteins, it's like running a factory at a really high rate of production. You are going to see rates of quality slowly decrease over time. So if you're constantly pushing this machinery in your body to keep making proteins, it is going to make small mistakes, and our body's intelligent and that it has safety mechanisms to clean up some of these mistakes. But if those mistakes are occurring far, not far in between, our health is not going to be impacted. But if they're happening all the time, the body's trying to compensate for it, that's where you start to see like dysfunction occur towards like your skin health, wrinkles, you're losing the rigidity of the collagen. So you start to see that keeping this sort of, repair of the body in an optimal state ties in with fasting, and that you're restricting calories, you're restricting all these nutrient intake processes to the body to allow the body to sort of gain a level playing field of, okay, well, there's no nutrients present, let's actually devote ourselves to doing some of the tidying up. So let's clean out some of the dead cells, let's look at some of the cells that have become a little dysfunction and clean them away. So your fasting plays a big role into that. You're also training the body to utilize fatty acids for energy. So when you're at rest and you're fasting, your body has no choice but to either use some of the glycogen, which is the stored carbohydrate in your body, or your triglycerides, your fat that's stored inside your body for energy as well. So fasting is an amazing way towards longevity. And I guess looking at how you can, serve the body towards longevity and doing those restorative processes.
How does fasting though fit in with if you're training?
Yeah.
You're trying to get enough protein in. You want that lovely body composition. It can be quite difficult. I mean, I practice an 8-12 as much as I can. So I eat in an 8-hour window, and for 12 hours I'm not eating. But I've always enjoyed training fasted, so I train in the morning. In fact, I'm about to go and train now. But yes, I wouldn't. I've got used to it, but a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, from a very high level perspective, and I only spoke about this recently on another podcast, and this was geared towards, can you do bodybuilding and have longevity? And it sort of comes to a clash between you can resistance train and maintain a decent amount of skeletal muscle mass, because you're still going to be able to get adequate protein in during your sort of eating window versus your fasting. But from a very high level perspective of pretty much every 2 to 3 hours, you need to stimulate the machinery that builds protein in your body true nutrition in order to continuously keep making proteins, that if you're looking to be like a very high level competitive bodybuilder, you have to eat every 2 or 3 hours to stimulate this machinery. But for the average person who's looking to either build a small amount of muscle to serve their longevity, or look for, you know, health composition goals of serving their health, but also serving how they look physically, fasting can play into that, because you still have a sufficient window over 8 hours where you could still have 4 decently sized meals every 2 hours, where, okay, you're not stimulating muscle protein synthesis every 2 to 3 hours over an 18-hour window. You've now moved that to, you know, every 2 hours over an 8 hour window. So you're still potentially getting four feedings, but it's more compact, and you're probably not able to have the same food volume in terms of your carbohydrates and your fats, but you can still have the same protein intake. So if you're looking at your 1 gram per pound, you know, if that equates to 100 grams of protein, you can have four meals of 25 grams of protein every 2 hours over that window. So you can still serve your baseline nutrition needs to sort of maintain or even help with body composition. But from a bodybuilding perspective and trying to gain as much muscle mass as possible, or a high level tiered athlete who needs to repair their body at a high rate, then fasting windows, either you commit to potentially doing a full fast once per week where you just fast for 24 hours. But then of itself, if you're a professional athlete, you can't really afford to have a day where you've got no nutrition, because the nutrition you eat on the day after training is serving the next day's training. So it's sort of like the longevity perspective of fasting in terms of being an athlete, as to speak, is quite difficult if you want to maintain a high level. But from a longevity perspective, fasting, looking at potentially limiting protein and carbohydrate intake, like when you get down into the nuance of the research towards longevity, there's two sides to it. They vilify proteins and they vilify carbohydrates. And then they vilify fats from a lipid peroxidation perspective, where your fats get damaged by your body and contribute to that oxidative stress. And I think it at the crux of it all, when you sort of band the three of them together, it still comes down to, again, that antioxidant intake, supporting your body's enzymes that help to protect you from that oxidative stress. So it's almost like your eating practice and the timing of your eating is important, but it still comes back to the composition of food that's going in during the eating window to be just as important. Because again, it can be the same as someone fasting, even doing a sort of extended fast, so like a 16-8 or even higher 24. During that 4 hour period, if they're eating like pizza, burgers, chips to make up their calories, you know, they're sort of putting products into the body that potentially have hydrogenated fats or polyunsaturated fats that can get damaged. And whilst they're gaining some benefit from fasting, the nutrition they're putting in following the fasting protocol is actually, you know, either balancing or undoing some of the work that the fasting has done.
It's interesting that you mentioned then, sorry, I said before 8-12. I realized my maths was totally out on that. It's 8-16 that I follow. But I've been eating just twice a day, but you say it's best to break it up maybe four times to get the protein in.
So you've got this machinery in your body that basically does muscle protein synthesis. Mm-hmm. And that machinery, that factory, as to speak, to make it a little easier to understand, relies on the amino acid leucine in order for the factory to be switched on. So for the electric to go onto the factory. And then the factory produces your proteins from the amino acids that are coming in through your diet. So every 2 or 3 hours, that factory is looking for between 2 and 3 grams of leucine from a complete protein source, in order for the muscle protein machinery to operate in the body. So if you're eating only 2 meals during the day, that muscle protein machinery is only running for whenever you eat the first meal. And then if there's a period afterwards where you're not ingesting protein, it's sort of switched off, and then you're switching it back on again for to run again following the ingestion of the second meal. Now, from a longevity perspective, that can be a good thing, because effectively, the less times that factory runs, the less mistakes it's going to make. But the other side is the less times that it runs, the less proteins that are being made for the body. So our whole understanding of longevity science, as to speak, is still very primitive, in that we don't really understand what's the optimal way to eat, what's the optimal timing to eat, other than we understand this muscle protein synthesis gets elevated for 2 to 3 hours after eating a complete protein meal. So if we're eating every 2 to 3 hours to elevate that machinery that serves towards our muscle protein building, which again is great for a competitive athlete who's looking to continuously keep repairing muscles that are getting broken down, but might not be convenient, say, for someone who's working a normal job, trying to eat every 2 or 3 hours, or might not even serve their longevity goals, and that they don't need this same high level of output as an athlete as well.
Wow. Well, I think it's made me realize again, because I remember, you know, the competition and I was constantly eating through the day. And then that's changed over the past sort of couple of years, listening more and more about longevity, but also feeling my body composition does change. And as a woman as well, when we age, and I turned 52 a month ago, you know, it is much more difficult to keep that body composition. And, you know, you don't want to overtrain either, because that has its effects. Yeah. So I'm trying everything at the moment. Is there any other suggestions that you have for sort of menopausal women? I don't know if you've got any sort of supplements that sort of help.
Yeah. So
women going through the change.
So I guess when it comes to with menopause, we have quite a number of different things that can occur in terms of our hormonal balance in females. And that's either we start to see issues where progesterone isn't being made enough or estradiol isn't being made enough. So that's sort of where it's now becoming a lot more mainstream and acceptable for hormone replacement therapy, where we're giving the body the bioidentical source of that hormone to balance the profile more appropriately. So obviously, one of the things that does start to slow down is our estradiol production in females as a female goes through the menopause. And so that estradiol level contributes to skin health, to your neurotransmitter profile in your brain, to the mucosal production within the female reproductive system. So there's a lot of things that play off these hormones that, from a supplement perspective, there are some supplements that do have a level of benefit. And again, you're coming back to all the basics of your B vitamins, your micronutrients, vitamin D, potentially for helping with mood stabilization. We have our adaptogens, which are herbs which help with our the stress response of the body. We have certain nutritional intake of like fatty acids. So you've got your omega-3s, you've got your phosphatidylcholine, which again contributes to your membrane health of your cells. Stuff like that tends to be where the forefront comes in towards balancing out where the nutrition isn't supporting during that period. But the other side is there are a lot of like gray area supplements or supplements where people have really not abused, but thought that we should throw all these supplements at females regardless of what blood work is showing. And that, you know, it's the likes of your Vitex Agnes and well, be another one, black cohosh, horny goat weed. You've got these keen herbs which do have good clinical efficacy, but they need to be matched to the patient as opposed to just being a blanket recommendation. So it's important, you know, again, it comes back to blood work and being diligent as a person's going through the menopause to look at their blood work. Look at potentially doing, you can do functional tests that look at your neurotransmitter profile. So looking at how maybe the serotonin's being affected in your brain, how the dopamine's being affected in your brain, any sort of cellular inflammation that might be coming from that skew in hormone balance. And also looking towards then the adrenal glands with a perimenopausal or menopausal woman, in that during the sort of earlier life cycle of a female, the ovaries are what are producing a lot of the sex hormone in terms of progesterone and estrogen. And as the sort of life cycle of the ovary starts to come to a close, the adrenal gland is where a lot of the sex hormone production then shifts over to for later life. So your testosterone, your estrogen, and your progesterone shift over towards the adrenals. So the adrenals tend to be the one that needs to be nurtured quite heavily during that period.
That's interesting. And how do you nurture your adrenals?
So we have to sort of look at your adrenals produce quite a lot of different hormones. So you've got your cortisol, you've got DHEA, you've got pregnenolone, you've got all these what would be considered steroids that your body produces in order to serve, you know, energy metabolism. Your cortisol, your stress hormone, helps your body to sort of produce adrenaline and release glucose to get you sort of out at, if you're in a fight or flight situation. So what we can do is we can do blood work to look at your sort of DHEA production. So that gives us an idea into how well is the adrenal making one of the base hormones that are created in the adrenal gland. We can look at the cortisol level in the blood to see is the cortisol response from the adrenal gland being sufficient. So again, if you're a chronically stressed person or you're relying a lot on caffeine where you're constantly stimulating cortisol production, you effectively want to see where those numbers are and then maybe look at, do you need to supplement with a little bit of DHEA to help the adrenal gland produce the adrenal hormones that are required? Do we need to implement, you know, adaptogens which help your body adapt to stress so that we're no longer pumping out a lot of this cortisol or we're not utilizing some of the base substrates? So your adrenal gland will basically make templates of different steroids, and those steroids then are created from these templates. So if you have one dominant, I guess, chemical process like making a lot of cortisol when you're stressed, you're effectively pulling those adrenal hormones down to cortisol instead of over to something that could be beneficial like testosterone, and obviously testosterone creating estrogen as well. So it's when it comes to sort of guiding that menopause, there's the adrenal health at the forefront, and then obviously looking at hormone imbalances and seeing is there a need for bioidentical hormone replacement in order to keep those levels stabilized between progesterone and estradiol.
It's quite an interesting one, because very often or not, I mean, I've been to the doctors, and you know, the NHS do a job, but you really have to go in there with an well-informed to almost tell the doctors what you want. So when I went in, it was about a year ago, and I was describing my symptoms, they were like, okay, we can put you on HRT. But the one thing they didn't want to do was put me on testosterone. Now, I'd read up a lot about testosterone. I'm at the gym. I knew my strength was dropping. And I was like, look, I really want my testosterone tested. And you know, I had to go back at several times for them to say, okay, we'll test it, but we don't usually give testosterone. And they tested it, and mine was super low, like really, really low. And I've just got to say, it's a game changer. I've been on it for 6 months now, and I feel like a new woman. You know, my energy's come back, my libido's come back. I feel like a 20-year-old again. Amazing, amazing. So, but again, and every woman is different, so I'm not suggesting that for every woman. But it's certainly something that the NHS won't necessarily push for. You have to push for it.
Yeah, no, 100%. And that's sort of where you are limited with classical training. And there is good cause, because what we then start to see is that we definitely don't want the same situation in the HRT stigma towards males is slowly changing, and that every male is sort of starting to realize the importance of controlling testosterone as they age, and you know not being afraid to go down that route of discussing HRT or TRT in the case of males, but also being very careful of the message that we are educating, that it's very specific to the individual's needs, as opposed to HRT for everyone or TRT for everyone. That these things, in my mind, are absolute game changers when the setting is correct and the patient understands it. And it is one of the ones that, again, supplements are going to help in terms of helping with the adrenal glands, so that your adrenal can potentially make more testosterone. But it's definitely not going to do the same job of using a small amount of a testosterone cream to correct a hormone imbalance. So if the again, if the adrenal health isn't correct, and this is, you know, a big thing or a big level of discussion, we have an education platform with Supplement Needs where we deliver in-depth education surrounding all these topics. And one of them on the team is Olivia Orchowski. And she's like a leading female health expert in Australia. And she's come into sort of the holistic health industry by having been a very high level model and a very high level competitor in terms of physique and bikini competing, that she's now trying to make even, you know, young girls aware of where the fallacies of doing intense dieting phases, chronic dieting, chasing after this sort of social media image of having to be lean all the time or having to try and compete all the time, and show them again that you have quite scary practices and that you have female competitors who might be in their mid-20s who are suffering with amenorrhea, where they haven't had a menses or a bleed in quite some time as a consequence of their diet, which tends to come from chronic malnutrition, as to speak, if you want to phrase it that way. And following, say, competing in a competition, are looking to regain back menstrual function. And now we sort of have very coy physique coaches who think it's clever to tell a female in that position who has chronically low testosterone as a consequence of malnutrition to go and utilize a small dose of testosterone to correct that health deficit, as opposed to, like, my personal understanding and way I try to view it the same way as Olivia does, is the female produces testosterone from the adrenal glands first and foremost. So if testosterone is low, look at the adrenal gland health, look at all the lifestyle factors affecting the adrenals, and then try and help correct that before going down the route of using HRT, specifically in these sort of very young females who, again, have probably self-induced these issues through, you know, chronic stress of dieting and obviously the malnutrition that comes with the chronically low calorie dieting.
But that education platform sounds amazing. And I think this sort of education we do need to get out to women, definitely. So I'll put a link, I'll definitely put all your links in the show notes below that. And just talking a little bit more about that female stack, because I know you've got a specific set of supplements around that. Is the adrenal sort of, is that one of them?
So one of them is the what's called the AM priming stack. So it's for morning time use, and that has a complete blend of six different adaptogens. So six herbs that have been proven to help your body become more resilient to stress. So again, if your brain doesn't perceive something as a threat or a stressful event, you're less likely to have a response from the adrenal gland. And so these adaptogens help us to regulate our emotions a little better so that we're able to, again, coax the adrenal into not being in this sort of constant fight or flight. The other thing that is coming now in the next, I think, 8 weeks, it should be pretty much ready. Are two supplements that are going to be geared towards, like, female fertility in terms of addressing some of the micronutrient deficiencies that can come from a normal day diet, alongside some supplements that can help to regulate fertility and help with overall fertility health towards conception. So that's one of the products that I'm really excited to
Wow.
launch, which I have Olivia testing with blood work through some case studies to gather the data, because again, a lot of the supplements that we make have gone through rigorous testing before the release. It's not a matter of, oh, well, here's like a female fertility or pregnancy multivitamin that, you know, has been thrown together with just basically trying to buy into a market to get people to give you money. All the supplements that we've created have gone through blood testing, or they've gone through rigorous sort of I guess questionnaire processes to gather the correct information for to understand that the product does work. Because again, to me personally, with making a lot of these supplements for myself, they have to work for me personally in order for me to really see that they're going to have benefit to someone else who's outside my household. So the female range, we've got the fertility female multivitamin and micronutrient with some other ingredients to help support overall fertility health. And then I've got a sort of premenstrual syndrome or premenstrual dysphoric syndrome supplement that's designed again to help with some of the dysfunctional brain chemistry that can come around PMS, and also helping to calm the body's response towards PMS as well. So those are my first two sort of female centered products that have taken quite a while to research and formulate, because again, I didn't just want to make supplements that would just fill a gap. So I think the female fertility product is my sort of biggest product today. Off the top of my head, I think there's 27 different ingredients in it. So it's quite comprehensive, and we don't cut corners. Whenever I'm making something, I really want to look at all avenues and how can I incorporate as much as possible into it to, again, give the consumer their health needs sort of first. And then obviously value is a big thing as well. You're only having to buy one product instead of 15.
Dean, what do you want to be remembered for?
Oh, this is a very interesting question. I guess my background is obviously with drug design and drug development. I was always really interested in science. And I guess when I was younger, my ambition was to be a medical doctor. And then I really changed my mind when I got to the end of my sort of secondary level education. I seen the sacrifices that, you know, doctors had to make from a personal perspective, that to me, it sort of didn't fit in with my sort of future vision for myself. I guess as I've sort of, you know, delved into the bodybuilding world, how I've interacted with so many people with supplement needs, I think how I want to be remembered is sort of the person who brought about a shift in the mindset of competitive bodybuilders, especially male competitive bodybuilders, to realize that their health needs to come first, regardless of a trophy, and that they need to view their sort of vitality post-competitive life as being the most important. So what you sort of do in your 20s will set the scene for your sort of 40s and 50s when you do settle with a family and have children. So for me, I really want to be remembered by being the person who spoke openly to educate the sort of young bodybuilders on their future health implications that can come from certain choices they make, and show them that there isn't sort of that, I guess, disparity, that they're sort of doomed to having ill health from some of their choices, and that if we apply the correct nutrition, the correct supplementation, and the correct knowledge, practices like competitive bodybuilding and perhaps using performance enhancing drugs during your sort of early competitive years doesn't bring about the same sort of stigma of ill health that you are being led to believe. And so it's a matter of giving a sort of a message of hope and a message of, I guess, future longevity, and that your future longevity is in your hands. And with where we are today, you don't have any excuse but to not take care of your health.
I think that's so important as well. And I love that the body, you're clearly the passionate about bodybuilding. And funnily enough, I'm very passionate about bodybuilding and trying to convince women to pick up weights, especially how I've known the importance in later life. But to also know that if you are taking performance enhancing drugs, and you know, I was in the world, and I, you know, we got on stage with men, and I never took any performance enhancing drugs, but there were a lot of people behind backstage that were. But also to know that it's not, like you say, it's not to be vilified, and there is a way to help your body Because it is one thing doing something in your 20s. You know, we've all done all, I mean, I'm still doing fun stuff, but it doesn't mean that you have to change your whole life and that that's it, doom and gloom for the rest of your life. It's just about, yeah, how you moderate it and take into account what it's actually doing to your body. And if you can help with those effects, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Finally, where can people hear more about you, Dr. Dean? I'm going to call you that. And we'll put the links as well on supplement needs. I'm dying to delve in. Sleep Stack is definitely one I'm going to be looking at, and potentially the adrenal as well.
So my Instagram tends to be the best place to get me. That's I tend to stay away from as many social medias as possible and just stick with Instagram. So my Instagram is DeanSTM, DeanSTM. Our website for supplement needs is supplementneeds.co.uk. And for anyone that's listening, my own personal discount code is Dr. Dean, which will save 10% off the whole website. And then our education platform, which has informative videos on our products, first and foremost, aside from the sort of paid membership education platform with the other educators alongside me. And that website is sneducation.co.uk.
Fantastic. And finally, my last question, what are the key messages that from our conversation that you think our audience should take away?
I guess the first one would be test, don't guess. So always use sort of investigative processes to figure out if you have a nutritional requirement for a supplement. So we're in an age where there's open access to private blood testing, private functional health testing, that we don't have any excuse if we feel off or we feel we have certain symptoms. Go and have something tested or approach a appropriately qualified medical professional over your symptoms.
Do you recommend any through supplement me?
There's the company who we work alongside in Manchester is the Blood Lab, thebloodlab.co.uk. We have an affiliation with Omnis, who do a lot of functional health testing. So between those two, you should be well covered in terms of your blood testing or your functional health needs, certain like neurotransmitter profiles, hair mineral analysis. So all these things play a big part in giving you the data on whether you need to take a supplement or not, or whether you need to increase your antioxidant intake, etc. The other side would be to be mindful of what you sort of listen to from an education perspective on supplements, and don't buy into, you know, social media hype or being influenced towards taking something just because someone else is. That again comes back to that individuality of that supplement might be best suited for that person, but not suited towards yourself. I think the final one would be not to be afraid to experiment if in terms of your sort of understanding of food. Whilst we all sort of buy into the different dieting tribal practices, very few people ever take the time to understand what foods serve them better. So do you feel better eating carbohydrates? Do you feel better eating fats? Do you feel, you know, that you store fats as fats, or do you store carbohydrates as fat? Being able to understand, and again, being very objective towards the data you gather from that sort of experimentation will serve you much better than following, you know, a restrictive guideline practice of, oh, whether you're to only eat, you know, 1200 calories today, and that 1200 calories can come from whatever you like, knowing that your body has its own biochemistry, which is unique to you. And then understanding that the nutrition you give that body is what will fuel you towards either being healthy or being in a disease state. And what we all want to do is eventually get to our sort of 70 and 80 years of age, where we are in still our sort of health span versus our disease span, so that we have years of health and vitality as opposed to just years of existence.
Fantastic. Well, I've definitely got another 50 years to go. Certainly in me. Dr. Dean, look, thank you so much. I think this has been super educational. I've loved it. I've picked up loads of massive nuggets. So thank you so much for being a guest on my show.
Thank you very much, Sonia.